Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hello again and welcome. And we are sitting in my garden. We've met again. It's lovely.
It's
hello,
so she says,
shouting across the computer.
Yes. Hurrah for faces and voices and being in the same place.
Yes. Yes, and both being able to sit outside. I'm sorry about the traffic noise, and it's quite possible the RAF will shoot something over at some point too.
Oh my goodness.
But we've got the bird song, we've got the view, and we're actually seeing each other. We're sharing, well, not sharing a cup of tea, but it's lovely. And the timing is perfect because this Saturday night at 10:40 something, because I've just looked it up, because I'm not that wise that I know, is the summer solstice. So please, Susie, talk to me about the solstice.
Well, sol, sun, stis, standing still. So the solstice is that time of year that we have twice, obviously enough, summer and winter, when the sun seems to stand still and it rises and sets in what look like, or I mean what actually are, probably are, the exact same place for 3 days, while we have at the summer obviously the longest days and in winter the shortest days. And so it's the time when the balance of the world tips, really, from, I mean, it's such a short moment. It's odd in a way, you know, we get, the days get from the winter solstice, get longer and longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. And then for 3 days, they're the same. And then round we go again, shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, until for 3 days, they're the same again. And round we go longer and longer. And so it's in some ways, I mean, maybe exclusively to me, I don't know, but I find it in some ways kind of strange that there are only these 3 days at the top and the bottom of the year, as it were, when the daylight is actually the same. The rest of the time, we are constantly in movement. And so in our kind of pagan myths, if you like, for want of a better expression, the time of the year when the light is constantly getting longer and longer and longer, belongs to Bridget. So she of the spring and plenty and the light and creativity and, you know, all the things that we associate with the goddess who we tend to see mostly as maiden, but also as mother, as inspiration, as poetess, as smith, as, you know, all those amazing things. And then as soon as we get to the solstice, we start stepping out again into the world of the Kaliach. So the old hag of winter, she who gathers her sticks to burn fires to keep us warm, she of the abundance of the harvest also, though, before we get to those crony days of winter. And so that's the kind of feminine, I don't know, side of the story. And then the other side of the story is the Holly King and the Oak King. And so the Holly King is, the Oak King, I beg his pardon, is now deposed by the Holly King. And so...
Oh, I see. And those are the husbands or the partners of the...
Well, they're just one half's receptive, the other half's active.
Yeah, so they don't have to actually be in a relationship.
No, I mean, they are because they're the halves of the year. But, you know, I do think, I mean, I know it's a really hot topic right now. But on the one hand, I think it's very clear and easy to understand stories that are about, you know, masculine and feminine, kings, queens, Bridget, Kaliach, whoever. But actually, when we get down to it, these are stories of the active and receptive powers, and they have nothing whatsoever to do with gender. And in a day, in these days when gender is such a hot topic, I think that we need to stop using gendered language to describe active and receptive, because I think it's really not useful, and it's promoting a version of duality which is you know, where genders are seen as being in opposition, which is, again, massively not useful. And
absolutely. And we are at the point where the patriarchy spell is cracking. And that's almost certainly why we are getting far more focus on transgender, homosexuality, all these words that can be used in pejorative ways, but are actually about humanity recognizing that it isn't two genders. And the Native American Indians used to have words for people like that. And in fact, it's only the last couple of hundred years that we've got so hot-topicked about these things. And in the Christian world, for example, the issues are homosexuality and abortion. And they've lowered it down to sins of the flesh, which are recent, if you know what I mean. They're recent. Forever, women have controlled their own fertility as well as they could. In Jesus' day, I wrote a book once called The Book of Deborah, which was about the Holy Family, and had to research all the herbal lore of those days, which was quite difficult. This was sort of pre-internet everywhere, and I'd sit in libraries and read old books. And it was extraordinary, the use of chrysanthemum and mistletoe and all kinds of things. And you had to be so careful and so wise, but there was love within it, because in those days, without contraception, a woman would be worn out and toothless by 30.
Wow. Yeah, it's quite a thought.
Because all the calcium out leaching out of her body and constantly childbearing. And even in the time, you think of Queen Anne, who gave birth to 17 children, all of whom died.
Oh, my goodness.
While being Queen of England.
Whoa, I did not know that.
Yes, miscarriages and stillbirths and postnatal deaths. And still managed to be Queen of England. It's utterly astonishing when you think about it. So the cycles of life have to be all applied with love. That's the original Christianity. That's the original pagan belief, which is you look at these things which are judged as wrong and look at them with love and say, what's actually happening here? Because God doesn't make mistakes. What's actually going on here? And I'm diverting all over the place now, but I really want to get this in, though I'll come back to the solstice. I know so many women with whom I've worked who've had abortions, who had the same soul come back when they were ready. Mm. Because you can't kill a soul before birth. You can't kill a soul anyway in the mystical Christian teachings. The soul is immortal. Mm-hmm. But the physical body, certainly you can destroy. But before birth, and even after birth, I know of one woman who had a baby die soon after birth. And 6 years later, she said to me, I know it's the same one. I know it's the same soul. I know it is. And if we could just open up to that kind of thing, how much grief would it absolve? How much grief would it help to know? My favourite story is of a woman who never forgave herself for having an abortion when she was about 18. She married the man who was the father of the child, but she was pressured by her parents. This is more than 40 years ago now. Mm. Pressured by her parents not to have an illegitimate child because her fiancé was away in the armed forces. And she never forgave herself. Mm. It felt like a terrible, terrible thing to do for social convention. Mm. And I suggested that she wrote, I can't tell this story without crying. And before I go on, I'm going to say, when I cry, when I talk, it sounds like I'm laughing. I'm not, I'm crying. So I said, write an angel letter, which is a letter to the soul, which you can write to somebody living or dead, to explain and to ask for a sign for forgiveness if necessary. And I said, write to the soul of your child and say, I am so sorry. Can you let me know if you're okay? Mm. And she wrote this letter. And within 48 hours, she had a phone call from her son, who was 19 and living in South Africa at that point. And he said, Mum, Mum, are you okay? I had this terrible dream where you were begging at my feet, saying that you killed me.
Oh, my God, I'm going to cry too. Wow.
I know. And you just suddenly, oh, my God, how much pain could we alleviate if we worked at the soul level?
Yeah.
And back to the solstice.
Oh, I'm not sure I can do that.
Okay,
what a story.
Fair enough. Keep going,
oh
then.
My goodness. What a story. It's exquisite. Yeah.
And Christianity mostly has just lost this. It was founded by a guy who loved everyone. who made no distinctions between male, female, illness. And like St. Francis, my father St. Francis, you know, he touched lepers. He walked with everybody because he just saw the beauty and perfection of their soul. And in his presence, they could not do anything but heal.
Mm.
You know, and oh, wow, wouldn't it be just wonderful if you were the kind of person who, when somebody walked past you or touched you, they were healed. And they never had to know it was you.
Yeah.
You know, that's the ultimate goal, that you don't have to go around saying, I'm a healer. You just carry that presence that you could walk past and people could draw through it.
Yeah.
And that's what a human's meant to be, surely.
Well, I have such a sense that that is how we could be, because we live in a world where everything is made up of the same stuff and everything is interwoven and interconnected. We are related to everything, and everything is part of this extraordinary warp and weft that is the divine made matter. And that if we are whole, wholly ourselves, healed, then we emanate that wholeness. And that walking around whole, and therefore, presumably, being somebody who's not walking around full of judgment and full of hatred and, you know, all the other bizarre stuff that we get to carry around sometimes as humans. If we are walking around just absolutely full of love and gratitude for life and full of acknowledgement of the blessings that are the gift of our lives, then we become so many things. We become walking permission to do that on a basic level. We become an emanation of that, which is then a call to be that. And we become, I can't think of a better way of saying it than proof of the possibility that that's a real thing. And every time we take a step towards our own healing, we are taking a massive step towards the healing of all humans, because we're interwoven and interconnected.
Mm.
And so, you know, I'm sure everyone probably can relate to this idea that when you are in the presence of somebody who is maybe really grounded or just really, really kind, you feel your heart open. You feel yourself connect. You feel maybe some judgments or some ways in which you're pissed off with the day or whatever just drop away. And so I actually, you know, I really do feel that that is something we can be and should aspire to being.
Yes, and that has to be the goal. And we're talking, we're right still in the middle of all the demonstrations and protests after the murder of George Floyd in America, and highlighting so many other injustices. And we're in the stage right now of the anger, which it has to come up because there's so much poison in there, so much justified fury and grief and
Absolutely.
All that. And we've all got to get over it. At some point, we've got to lift humanity, all humanity, to say there is one thing about privilege, which means that you walk as if you have a right to be there. And I'm not talking about nasty privilege as in putting another person down. What I'm talking about is something that both you and I have on our good days, which is the right to be here. Because we have both got the ability to walk through a place where some people might judge we aren't meant to be while being invisible.
Mm.
Because we are on a mission from God, from spirit, that we know that we have to be there. The amount of times I've walked through a hospital to somebody or something like that, where technically I should have been stopped, but it was just a case of going, this is where spirit wants me to be, therefore I am in partnership with spirit, I just walk as if I own this place. And I think our black and other racially indigenous brothers and sisters, it's so difficult to know what the word is now, could do with learning that so that they can walk forward in joy. This anger and this horror of that's coming up has got to be acknowledged honoured and healed somehow. Otherwise, it's just going to go round again.
Yeah, but I, you know, the anger is, this is righteous, healthy anger.
Oh, I agree.
And,
yeah.
And I, you know, I...
Feel free to disagree with me 100%. Well, this is what discussions are for. Because you'll change my mind if you...
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, yes, wouldn't it be amazing if we could all, you know, get over all the things that make us angry. But I think that's... I don't think that time has come. And I think... If I'm, don't know, I'm trying this out on my tongue because I'm very aware that, you know, I'm a bloody middle-aged, middle-class white woman. What the fuck would I know about any of it, really?
Me too, yes. I can add up to that. And I really don't want to offend anybody. I want everybody to be happy. I'm just trying to work out a way that we can get to that. But you're right, it's probably too soon.
Yeah, I think it's way too soon. And I think we need... We need permission to be angry, not just those who have borne the brunt of all of this, but actually all of us. Mm. We should be really, I personally feel really fucking angry. Mm. I don't want to live in a world where people like me judge other people to be less than themselves. Mm. I find that disgusting. Mm. And it makes me... It does. It makes me so angry and so, so sad that every part of the foundations of what we think of as normal is built on torture and enslavement and disrespect and avarice and, you know, just a list of all the other, the most repellent words you can think of, which can be applied pretty exclusively to people who look like you and me. Mm. And we are the descendants of those people. And just as much as, you know, I relish statements like, you know, we are the daughters, granddaughters, whatever, of the witches they failed to burn, you know, hurrah, but we're also the granddaughters of colonialism and... Yeah, slavery, torture, disrespect, invasion, social manipulation on a scale that's barely conceivable of power over rather than power of. And that our focus in the West, and I don't know whether it's a kind of human focus or is it a white focus or is it a historic focus, I don't know, but our kind of obsession with what's different rather than what's the same. And you know, that then goes right back round to, let's get over this bloody conversation about the opposing forces of masculine and feminine and start calling it receptive and active. Because we seem to be, as a culture, we have our knickers in the most enormous knot about, ooh, look, they're different. Ooh, I probably don't like them, or they're not as good as me. And that's got to be coming from, you know, fear and guilt and God knows what else. Where did it go so wrong, really, that all we're looking at all of the time is, well, that person's different from me, and therefore... Depending on who you are, either I'm going to be a bit afraid of them, or I'm going to try and get one over on them, or I'm just going to avert my eyes and walk the other way because I know I'm out of my depth. We've got to get over ourselves. And I think righteous anger for all of us, I feel fucking angry and I'm white, female, middle class. You know, imagine the level of anger that there must be in the bodies, basically, of those who do not have any of my privileges and live in a world that shows them so little respect. God, I'm going to cry now.
No, I get that. And I'm one of these really annoying people who says, how do we lead everybody through? Probably because I don't know. I'm over that bit of anger. I've got other pockets of anger. And I've also lived in Republican America.
Mm-hmm.
And very white America too. But I saw that people there who met strangers of different colour were more interested. And I was really surprised about that in the heart of Montana. I was expecting, you know, when a black person came to town or something, that there might be prejudice or something like that. But we ran a cafe and sometimes people would come in. And this is one of the things which I think can be difficult for people other than us, was that the staff were curious. They'd go and talk to them. Where are you come from? Where did you come from originally? And the black folk, of course, would get quite annoyed by it. And I think that's another aspect that sometimes needs to be looked at, in that sometimes when you don't know something, you're curious about it, but the person about whom you're curious has had too much curiosity. So I think familiarity may be one thing that I'm going round in circles here. I mean, the wiring of the brain is that if something is other than us, we're afraid of it. That's actually the wiring in the reptilian part of the brain. So we actually have to come to our souls to heal this.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm trying to say. I absolutely understand the anger. I'm not feeling, I feel more sorrow.
Mm.
But, I would so love to be able to do something to help. And I've tried on social media to post the odd thing, and every now and then I've just ended up offending. A friend of mine, an old friend from TV, and he's a mad, bad, dangerous to know guy, there's no doubt about it, but he had a partner who was Polynesian, and he lived in the Caribbean for quite some time, and he was debating with a black girl on my timeline, and he signed off something which, with his partner in the old days, was totally acceptable.
Mm.
I can't remember what the actual phrase was, but we're just covering the laptop with Susie's shawl at the moment because it's starting to rain and we are probably going to have to pause. We're on 21 minutes. Let me see if I can pause and we'll come back. Hang on. Okay, we're recording again, and we have moved to the garage because it is raining. And the reason why it's not our echoey is because this is a very cluttered garage, so I'm very sorry, Susie, you're sitting practically the other side of a pile of stuff that should be going to the tip by now. And even worse than that, we just recorded an absolutely scintillating another 20 minutes of this, which I failed to switch the pause button off. So we're going to try and recreate this. So what we were trying to go into was that basically we don't know what the fuck we're talking about, because we're not experiencing what is going on except from the periphery, are we?
Yeah. And that we are in many ways condemned to be kind of terminally inarticulate about this, because of the spells of our language. And that, exactly as we were discussing in the podcast before and the one before that, our capacity to relate in many ways is confined by our capacity to articulate in language what it is we're trying to convey, even to ourselves sometimes. So I believe that we are confined and defined to a degree by the way we are able to speak about something, and that almost that although we can feel about things, we can't almost think without words because we do tend to think in words.
And you pointed out to me, I'm sorry I'm interrupting you there, but I really want to say this before I forget. You called me on the bit that we failed to record on the use of the word we, absolutely correctly, because I had never actually realised what I was doing. Would you explain what it was I was doing?
Yeah, okay, so, and it came with an apology that it's going to sound rude, and I don't mean it to be rude, and that...
I'm just moving some things around so that we're going to be a little bit more comfortable. Right, go on.
Yes, that because of the constraints of our language, Maggie kept using the word we, you kept using the word we, which is by its very nature, in the way you were using it, exclusionary. We meant
We white folk.
We white folk. Yeah. Yeah. Or even potentially we middle-aged, middle-class white women. And that as soon as we use words like we in that way, we are immediately stepping into the place of othering. So if there's a we, there's kind of us, which automatically, because of the way our language is constructed, and as a result, therefore, because of the way in which our thought processes are constructed, there is a them, and so we are othering. And that, you know, that's one of the ways in which the English language is the voice of the kind of the spokesperson, if you like, for the patriarchy, for the culture of acquisition and the shoppyarchy or whatever you call it, that our whole language, our language defines almost what we're capable of thinking because we can't think past words. And that when we try to expand our thinking, so for example, when we're trying to talk about, I think I've said this before, how if you call a tree in a forest, she, if you say, there is the ash, look how beautiful she is. When a man comes along with a chainsaw, you feel about that ash tree so radically different if you understand her to be she than you do if it is an ash tree. It is, you know, if I called your grandmother it, you would be profoundly offended. But most people are not offended when I name, you know, a foxglove or anything that I can see just outside the garage, it. And that we do the same inadvertently to all things which we don't include in that extraordinary word, us. And that us in the West has come, it seems to me, to mean, and you know, I can only state over and over again, I know both of us can only state over and over again, how much we realise that we don't even know what we don't know.
No.
And that it's so hard for us to talk about. I mean, quite aside from all things related to our age, background, sex, etc. We also live in the Southwest, which is so predominantly white as to frankly be an embarrassment. And, I've lost my thread. That
it's about, you're talking about how we just put duality into everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's me and the other.
Yeah.
And how it is how our brains are wired. We're wired like Velcro for fear and like Teflon for happiness. That's actually how our brains are wired, the reptilian brain, fight or flight, fight, flight or freeze, other things. And so we actually have to constantly be taught to lift ourselves up to the level of trusting.
But, go. So how is it that we live in a world? So you say we're wired to...
Excuse me, I'm chasing a squirrel away. And failing. Keep going, Susie.
to live in a world where we perceive other human beings as something we should be afraid of because they're other is, I mean, that is beyond weird to me. To be afraid of a wolf because it's different and I know it might eat me is one thing, although from all I know about wolves, it's probably not going to eat me. But, you know, that to me, that the idea that a person of colour is so other than me that I should be afraid of them, that is not hardwired into my reptilian brain. I'm sorry, but it's not. That is culturally taught to me to see somebody whose skin is a different colour than mine as being radically different than me, rather than seeing a human being with 10 fingers and 10 toes and 2 eyes and 2 nostrils and every single fucking organ within them identical to mine. How in God's name did they become different to me rather than the same as me? You know, that's the level at which we have been indoctrinated and inculcated and made separate from rather than together with.
Absolutely. Yes, it's training because babies don't discriminate. But it's training that goes into the wiring. It's easy for us to learn it. I think. I'm not saying that's right at all, but let me tell you the story of Tattoo. Tattoo was a beautiful little pony at the riding stables where little privileged white kid, me, oh God, used to go when I was a child. And I got to ride Tattoo just a couple of times because he was quite a difficult pony. And one day I was there early and they said, tack up Tattoo and take him down to the school and we'll be down in a few minutes. And I tacked up Tattoo, took him down to the school, and there were some jumps in the school. And I was a wicked little girl and took Tattoo around the jumps, which was lovely. I had great fun. And when they came in, they said, well, what have you been doing? And I said, oh, I took Tattoo around the jumps. And they said, oh, no, you can't have done that. You're lying. Tattoo doesn't jump. I never got Tattoo over another jump again.
Oh,
that's yes. How powerful the indoctrination is on the wiring that we've got.
Yeah.
And it's harder to get us the other way around. There was no, oh my goodness, Maggie got Tattoo over the jumps. Tattoo can jump. Oh, that's amazing. Now let's see who else can get Tattoo to jump. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think, is the root of all this. The root of this great, extraordinary outsurge of anger. And now I'm the one who's... I'm quoting you from the bit that we didn't record about... I would love you to talk again about your level of anger about this, because what we're seeing is people coming out of depression, which is destructive, into anger, which is a really vital next stage.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, just one of the things I actually didn't say last time, which I would love to say, is that to me, that so anger becomes a destructive force more when it is unexpressed than when it is expressed. And healthy and righteous anger expressed in a healthy and righteous way can create healthy, righteous change. It really can. And it can create change really fast because it tends to come with that, you know, we call it a blaze of anger. It's powerful. And actually, I am by no means approving of or condoning or encouraging rioting. But wow, look what happened. Even in, you know, the sweet little southwest, Bristol, Colston, the statue of Colston, the slaver, got taken down and thrown in the harbour. And as a result, a result of that action, all kinds of councils all over the place, especially in Bristol, are going around the place going, oh, look, there's another statue to a slaver, a mass murderer, a torturer, whatever. Let's take them down. Let's actually replace them maybe with something which celebrates something which we all have cause to celebrate. That's inclusion and beauty and, you know, that thing we're always banging on about. That's about love. Mm-hmm. That's not about celebrating somebody who created the world in which we live through horrendous suffering and power over all the things that we know are what the patriarchy is completely founded upon.
Yes.
Of is murder, torture, you know, rape, pillage and plunder, the stealing of land, the total and utter annihilation of entire groups of people.
And Christianity is hugely complicit in that.
Yeah.
A faith that was started by a brown man who was from a part of Israel that was despised. He was a Galilean. Now, Galileans were utterly the hicks. They were the pagan-rooted people that you discounted. They were not as bad as the Samaritans who worshipped differently and wouldn't go to the temple. Oh, dear. But they were pretty, They were the working class to the middle and upper class Jerusalem folk. And we don't get taught that. Jesus was from the back end of nowhere. He was a hick. People would have the Galilean. Did anything good come out of Galilee? That's actually in one of the Gospels. You know, and this simple, loving man who never once said, oh, you're a Roman, I won't heal you. You're a Samaritan, I won't heal you. You're a leper, I won't come near you. Oh, you're slightly darker tinted than me. Oh, you're redhead, I can't heal you. Never once did any of that. Just stood there and said, You're perfect as you are. You're beautiful. Come to yourself. Mm. And that simple faith is now personified by a man's tear gassing people out of the way to stand in front of a church holding a Bible upside down to appeal to the Christian right. And this is the point at which I have to say that if I have any line as a follower of Christ, the Christ that started at the beginning of creation and ends at the end of creation, it's all through the Bible, it's in Ephesians, it's in Romans, Jesus says it, it's in Genesis, the whole aspect of the love of God, the creative aspect of God that was personified just for 33 years by one man, and probably by other people too, we just don't know about it, because guess what happens to the one we do know about? Gets turned into this law of division of us and them. Go back and read the bloody Bible. Read the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes, it's Makarios. It's translated as blessed, but it actually means happier. Content and at peace are the humble, the meek. Contented and at peace are those who are persecuted for the sake of the righteousness. Blessed, happy are those who are at peace with themselves, are at peace with humanity, are at peace with each other. Go and read the bloody book! For God's sake, it's so clear. This was a man who was despised from the back end of beyond, a threat, who probably deliberately turned over the tables in the temple. In the Gospel of John, this is what happens before he's arrested. He was saying, come and get me.
Do you know what, though, Maggie? All this makes me think is that Christianity gets blamed for a whole lot of stuff.
Mm.
But clearly that whole lot of stuff was already happening when Jesus was turning the tables over. So that kind of would suggest that it's not really Christianity's fault, that it was already, that was already the state of...
Thank you for saying that. I believe that's true, but yeah. Christianity has certainly carried it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they haven't turned around and done much about it, have they? You said, while we were so sadly not recording, you gave two great quotes, one which was possibly
G.K. Chesterton? Yeah. Oh, God, yes. Well, one from Richard Rohr, who was one of my great teachers in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who is just the most beautiful man and totally admits that he's also an ass. We all are, you know, that's the humility of it. He prays every day for a humiliation to make sure he doesn't become prideful. I haven't got to the stage where I need to pray for it yet. But and he sort of said he thinks Christianity is a great idea, it just hasn't been tried yet. And G.K. Chesterton, who unfortunately I believe was anti-Semitic, but this is the difficulty, you have people who have really bad aspects of them, but can also have good aspects. And he said, the problem with Christianity is not that it's been tried and found wanting. It's been found hard and not tried at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, as we said before, it's one of my goals. Let's take people back to the root of this. It's about love. It's about inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, stand up. The other aspect of us. How do I say this? Stand up, my friends, my colleagues, my brothers and sisters, and say, enough!
Yeah. Yeah.
And teach us, please, because I am both ignorant and innocent in this. I am saying the wrong things.
Yeah.
I don't know what language to use. I don't know how to help.
We almost don't have the language anymore. You know, and that's what I was saying, and now I can't remember what we have said on the thing and what we haven't, but that because of the way our language has been constructed over the many thousands of years that English has evolved, it has evolved in these times of the culture that we've got and all the repellent things that it stands on. And so we have lost our capacity to speak about an animate inclusive world without, to use your phrase, sounding like we're talking wanky bollocks. And so for example, what you were just attempting to say by my brothers and sisters, my colleagues or whatever, to a Native American, and I realise that through these podcasts, I keep sounding like I'm espousing sort of Native American spirituality as my way. It's so not.
Mm.
But to a Native American, that is so simply said. You say, all my relations. And in the expression, all my relations, is the absolute knowing that that includes every single piece of life.
The ash tree. Talk about the ash tree again, because I'm not quite sure if that came in. Everybody, if we're repeating ourselves, I'm sorry. We just want to get all the stuff about calling the ash tree.
Okay, so I think I've actually said it in the previous one. But anyway, so I just pointed out that if you refer to an ash tree as she, and if generally you know that the tree outside of your house happens to be an ash whose flavour is very much of she, but actually, you know, maybe if you lived in a world where all of life was acknowledged as being alive, perhaps you would have a language which wasn't so bloody binary, that you only had he or she or they, which I also have difficulty with because to me it is plural.
You wouldn't cut down an ash tree if you called it she, would
no,
you?
No, exactly. You wouldn't, you know, if you can take a chainsaw to that which is it and not flinch, but you cannot take a chainsaw to she. And likewise, if I was to refer to your grandmother as it, you'd be bloody offended.
Actually not, but I take the point.
Yeah. And that, you know, all of the life that we can see through this garage door, beautiful bird, which I'm ashamed to say I can't even identify, that's absolutely gorgeous.
Bullfinch, isn't it?
Is it a bullfinch? Yeah. Okay, he's lovely.
I know.
Sorry, derailed. That our language by default separates us from the rest of life. Because we don't have, you know, again, if you're really interested in this stuff, please read Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, which we put up a link to either last week or the week before. But she really gets to the bottom of how the languages of Turtle Island, the original languages, speak to the ways in which all of life is alive.
Mm.
And so... But English, modern English, our language speaks to us having a fundamental belief that things other than us are basically dead.
Mm.
And so we have power over those things. It's a language absolutely rooted in violation and domination, and everything is a resource, including people who don't, you know, here we go back to who don't look like us. You know, how did we get to that situation? But the thing that we need to address is that we have got to that situation. And at a really core level, we need to be talking about these ways in the way that you and I have talked about this stuff. You know, we both know we're as ignorant as hell.
Yep.
And it's almost impossible to have a proper conversation about this in the southwest of England, where there is almost nobody to have it with.
Mm.
And that, you know, yes, we know we're ignorant, but also our willingness to open our minds and open our hearts and open our vocabulary to this, just even in us too, the worm is turning, yes. Times are changing. We're starting to dig ourselves out of the hole that is the paradigm in which we were raised. And we, in our tiny, weeny little way, are helping to change it. And it is only through conversations, but also through understanding that even the language itself in which we are having these conversations is part of the paradigm that we must dismantle. We must take down a whole way of being and of speaking and of listening and of existing and of belief that is fundamentally based on power over the ash, the person of colour, the place that is not here. You know, it's power over.
Yes. And when we do feel threatened for any reason, by the land, by people, by anything, I'm going to take us back to that guy again. Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you. So I'm going to sound really self-righteous and wanky bollocks, but I pray for Donald Trump. I pray for Boris Johnson. I pray for the souls of the slave traders. Mm. Because ultimately, after the anger, we've got to work very hard to find love.
Oh, totally. And we can only find it through compassion for ourselves and all the ways in which we've been participating in this, mm-hmm. and compassion for others. So, yes, the likes of Orange Top himself and everyone, yeah. everyone, you know, no matter what their place in it. Yes, love. Yes, compassion. Yes, the willingness to be wrong and to change.
Yes. Well, let's close with that lovely quotation from Rumi, the Sufi poet. Somewhere there's a field beyond right and wrong.
I'll meet you there.